movement. There's been a change to the timetable. The last session of practice this year was scheduled to be just after the morning coffee tomorrow, from 11:45 to 12:25. Originally we had a talk scheduled, but the speaker dropped out. We were going to run a discussion session, but Professor Akira Furusawa has kindly volunteered to come in and give a talk. So the final talk of the meeting will be this one. The details will be up on the notice boards, but just in case anyone goes off after coffee thinking it's all over, there is one more talk. For the discussion session, we might say a few words about future praxis, if there's still time. Traditionally do this, but I think we have a praxis set up for next year. Anyway, okay, thanks, Alan.
Okay, thank you everyone for coming here for this morning session. First up we have Robert Kosick from RC Solutions talking on robust quantum control on information.
Okay, thank you, Howard. Thanks for the organizers for organizing and inviting. So it's been common to show pictures of your colleagues and co-authors. So you have Konstantin explaining something to me many years ago. I still don't understand it. Matthew working with the creatures of the earth, and Hirsch is lifting a piece of the control landscape to reveal the structure. Well, that's this. Okay, so Feynman is not a colleague. I wish he was, but I really respond to this particular statement about looking for at the specific implementation, what are the imperfections, and getting at some way to alleviate the havoc. So from an engineering point of view, there's something I mean by it. I don't know what he might have meant by it, but this is what I mean by it. So the process of control design in engineering is not just designing the controller. It's really understanding trade-offs, and typically between performance and uncertainty, or performance and the cost of the resources of sensing and actuation, and of course handling process variations and so on. Now, because you could substitute any system in here that you like, quantum or otherwise, and you still say the same thing if you're going to design a controlled system. but it's trade-offs, and I found this quote from Wiener, which to me exemplifies the frustration and difficulty of trade-offs. I hope you can read it. We are in the position of the man who has two ambitions in life. One is to invent a universal solvent, which will dissolve anything, and the other is to invent a universal container, which will hold anything. Any liquid. Whatever you do, you get frustrated. So that's the ultimate trade-off. Okay. So this is a path through this to some extent. The first part is robust fidelity maximization. And for that, I'm going to look at what I think of as specific implementation and uncertainty modeling, meaning unknowns in known sets. Then we'll look at fidelity estimation. So this is a little more solid ground. This is new. Combining the two is, I'll show you a little bit of a hint that that can work. And then in the shower a few weeks ago, I had this thought, which I want to give you later. So hang on. So this is one way to state the problem. And this is for quantum information. You're trying to make a logic gate or whatever it doesn't have to be quantum information, but if you're trying to make a map from the input to the output in a quantum system, I think you're faced with this problem. And here I'm saying you have a system ancilla bath environment. There's a set of controls. And you're trying to make a gate W, in this case in the system space, by tracing out the bath and the ancilla. If you want to do it in the code space, you just trace out the bath. But in principle, it's the same idea. And that's despite uncertainties about all parts of the Hamiltonian, noise in the control, and so on. And we'll look at performance as indicated by this particular kind of fidelity, which is sometimes called channel fidelity. But it's really an overlap between the desired unitary and every piece of the operator sum representation. So this is one when every operator sum element is proportional to W. Oh, I keep walking over to turn the thing. Okay. A little more abstractly, Don't look at the 64, I'll go very fast. More abstractly, the problem is I have a function I want to maximize, in this case fidelity. It has two pieces in it. One I have a handle on, which is theta, and one I don't, which is delta. And I can either do the worst case or the average case or some combination. We'll focus on the worst case because that's, I think, more relevant for quantum information. And the design variables are in some set cap theta and the uncertain variables in a set cap delta. Typically, the design variables are in convex sets, and I'll show you that in a minute. Most of the time, these can be convexified, the uncertainties. It doesn't have to be the way we do this. And the problem with this problem is that fidelity in the quantum case is not a convex function of either delta or theta in general. And that's because it's in the Hamiltonian, you have to raise things exponentially, and it's just that's where the problem comes in. And maybe that's where the benefit comes in too. So let's focus down on a particular problem. This is a single qubit. And single qubit is very rich still for what the problems we're facing are. So here I'm saying the Hamiltonian has a scalar control, an uncertain coefficient in the x, poly x, and another term which is uncertain in terms of its magnitude, omega z. Now what we've seen later, and it's not in the paper associated with this work, is that when we optimize the control to handle this uncertainty, it also handles uncertainty from a bath with the same magnitude. So that's an area that's interesting of using lower dimensional systems and bigger sets to handle things that you don't want to model. So here we'll fix the control to be piecewise constant over uniform intervals. And then this is the problem then that we want to solve. The fidelity is as defined. The unitaries move in a discrete manner, and the sets are as stated. So, I put a lot of words in the slides because in case anyone reads them, you can see what it says. A couple of things about this. We're going to use sequential convex programming, but many of these methods can reveal solutions you wouldn't have thought of, things that are not obvious. They also tend to hug the initial control, whether it's good or bad, and particularly if it's good. So coming up with good initial controls is also an issue. But of course, there's no guarantee of a global optimum. But you say, wait a minute, fidelity can max at 1. Great, so if we're near 1, we must be globally optimal. Well, that's not true for quantum information processing, because it's a big deal as to what the difference is between these kind of values close to 1. So let's look at something. And then I'll explain afterwards, but I thought it'd be good to get a look. So this is our single qubit system. Now, one uncertainty in omega, there's the control. 4 pulses are allowed in the interval of time 1. And I constrained the magnitude to 4 pi in the optimization. First, I'm showing, maybe unfairly, 2 so-called dynamic decoupling pulses, one of duration 4 pulses, although we allowed 4 pulses, one where you allowed 32. And the way it's set up is this pulse will create an x rotation at the end of that interval. And what you see happens is if you have too low a bandwidth, which is what this means, you can't get great fidelities. But if you allow yourself huge amplitudes and a lot of bandwidth, you can get rid of the uncertainty. But if that's not the setup, you can't do that. So here, for example, is an optimization where we try to maximize the fidelity at a value of 2, which is right in the middle of the range. And you can see it does it. I mean, basically, I let this go down to, 10 to the minus 16, the end of the life of MATLAB. And it's a little variation on this one. And this is for the identity gate, I should have said that. For the identity gate, sometimes you can see, because you can do things by hand a little bit and see why this happens, but not for other gates. But you get the same kind of phenomena. But if I say now I want the worst case fidelity over the whole range, this is what I get. And that's not obvious necessarily. But you're getting almost five nines at the worst. So that's a typical result. Then if you start playing around with a whole range of the same thing, one parameter, unfortunately here I call it a delta, it's still omega z. And you look at what happens over a whole range of deltas that you might have, or omega z's that you might have in a particular system. So for example, from 0.1 to 1, I can find a robust control that'll keep me below or almost near 5 or 6 nines. If I could confine that value to a smaller region, I can be down here. And the green circles are optimized at a particular point. But even those have some element of robustness in them. But if I can't design my system with this range of values, and I move to here, I can't do quite as well. And again, here I've constrained the amplitude of the signal. So this kind of picture you can get for more complicated systems, and we'll do one with at least two uncertainties. And it gives you a lot of information about the possible trade-offs that you have to face. In other words, what system has this value and this amount of time and that amplitude and so on. Okay, just a few comments about this problem. There's a lot of evidence computationally, you just saw it, and experimentally, that it's easy in a certain way to find good controls. Easy doesn't mean that you're going to not hit the stops computationally if you're doing simulation and you have a 12 qubits. It's not going to be easy. But if you could do it, you would find a solution. We already know from landscape analysis that under ideal conditions, there's no traps. But under non-ideal conditions, which I just showed you, we don't know what that structure looks like. And even for no uncertainty, a detailed analysis of the optimal solution trajectories isn't really known. If you want to talk about that later, I'll be glad to. But I mean something very specific about that. I think that's enough of those comments. So let me tell you what's at the heart of sequential complex programming and why I like it and why I think it's very useful. The centerpiece is solving a convex problem. And what you do is you expand the fidelity, in this case, you can expand it up to second order in an increment in the control. You can include a list. Delta L is a sample from the uncertainty set. So you have a whole pile of these things that you want to minimize. You can constrain the design variables exactly to the convex control constraint sets. So you don't have to fool around with that. And we also define, in this kind of procedure, a trust region where you're hoping that this works in that region. You can test. You have to test in the algorithm that you've actually satisfied that after the optimization. So this is the fastest step in the whole business. The slowest step is calculating the gradients, and if you want to do the Hessian, well, here I'm showing the negative Hessian. And the plus means I project onto the positive eigenspace, so I don't go in the wrong direction. So there's been a lot of work on this. Stephen Boyd's website and his lecture notes on that course has a lot of really good material on this that's very readable. One of his students worked on this for waveguides. We did it. I did it with Jun Zhang for transmission profile in a semiconductor, and finally we did it here. If you want to do average case, you just sum over the deltas instead of worst case. And one more thing about this. It's a big list of constraints, but convex optimization algorithms scale very gracefully with lists of constraints. Parameters is more quadratic, but there's a lot of it, not necessarily. So I'll pass this. That was showing the whole algorithm, but we can talk about it later. So I just want to show you some typical constraints you can incorporate exactly as control constraints. These are in the PRA paper. So if the signal generator is from some linear dynamical system, and it could be time varying as I show here by the kernel, but it has piecewise constant commands, then all of these constraints are convex sets. Magnitude, fluence, area, rate, they're all convex sets in the parameter theta. So they can be handled exactly. And you can come up with more elaborate things which are also convex sets or combinations of these things. What? I didn't even touch it. Okay. Laser pulse shaping is a little bit different. You can handle that. So you have a constant amplitude envelope function. You want to pick the, let's say, the amplitudes and the phases. Let's say the frequencies are fixed. Well, then you can write the control as a linear combination of all these thetas, which are simply the A cosine A sine. So if you say that the magnitude is constrained, then that works onto a constraint individually on each of these theta vectors. That's a convex set. And now you can put that in the program, come back with the thetas that satisfy this, and from that you can easily extract the ai and phi i. If you want to also vary the frequencies, that unfortunately is not strictly convex. You can add thousands of more frequencies, and now you have more thetas, but you can solve that problem and find out which frequencies are important. Uncertainties can be handled in this framework in a number of ways. One way is by sampling. So you have, let's say, a constant parameter or parameters, and you just sample in the set. Typical convex programming, depending on the number of variables, can handle thousands to hundreds of thousands of these. So you could do that. If it was a stochastic signal, then you would take, you know, some number of finite time points. I called it here M, and then sample. Now it's stochastic, so you're just going to get a random sampling of the whole set. You probably have to repeat that a number of times. That can be intensive. But that's a way to bring them in. In many cases, in most cases, these systems are designed to already be pretty good, so the uncertainties are small. And if they're small enough, you might get away with just approximating them by a Taylor series expansion. So here I've expanded the fidelity. We're done with that. Well, I might have one. I got one. Okay. I got this. It's red. I hope that's okay. We had green, so. All right. So you can expand the fidelity as a Taylor series, both in theta tilde, which is the increment in control, and delta, which is the uncertainty. And if it's a stochastic uncertainty for delta, then this is the constraint to make it at least bigger than some average value which you'd like to pick. Oh, but I'm going to need this for the, I need two hands then. If it's a deterministic uncertainty, what I mean is it's bounded infinity norm like this. Now this can arise from a probabilistic description. I'm going to take the 2 sigma or 3 sigma, or I have prior knowledge of ranges of parameters. In this case, the set that describes that level of uncertainty is also a convex set. It introduces another variable, gamma. So now you maximize the worst case fidelity and gamma at the same time, and that encompasses the set. So you, and this is great because it eliminates a lot of the sampling and a lot of the intensive computation. This is now doing nothing. This is nothing. No. Because the same battery that failed the...
What's not working? The laser pointer?
No, the laser pointer is working. My laser pointer is working, but the moving to the next slide isn't.
No, I know. That won't.
Oh.
I know that
one. Okay. So I'll do it. Okay. Yeah. All right, so in the paper that this refers to, we did an intensive study of the two uncertainty problem. And we did it for the identity gate, the Hadamard gate, the T gate, and different times and different pulses. And I'll just show you quickly some of the results. So this is for the identity gate with 5 pulses, time 1, time 2, 10 pulses, time 1, time 2. And this is a picture of omega z, omega x, and the colors you'd like to see go the light green to the red are the good ones. But even though this looks very good, this is also very good if you were in this very narrow range, and same over here. So it depends on the system. I'll just show you one more gate. This is the T gate, very similar. kinds of results. And again, it gives you the ability to understand the trade-offs in design in this particular case. Just verifying the small signal analysis, we took a stochastic signal which had a linear filter whose bandwidth kept varying to see it fit the curve. So the average curve, which we can compute from the second order criteria, is the dark line, and the circles are the samples. You see it fits very, very well. So that can be used in the algorithm to compute the optimal solution without having to simulate, because in this case it fits that very well. Just for fun, I did a 2-qubit example. This is made up. Of course, everything's made up. We need to do experiments, but this is made up, more made up than others. So there is no bath, but I'm just showing that. I wanted to compare what I call temporal control with spatial control. So temporal control meaning I'm going to put time signals into a Hamiltonian, and spatially I'm just going to pick a Hamiltonian in the same space. And so it's a C-naught that I'm after, and the nominal Hamiltonian would give me the C-naught, but I have a perturbation, you know, that picks on in every direction. And when we do that, discover something interesting. And I did this with a lot of different systems, and I was kind of surprised. That if you look at the, so whatever, where's the, there's the variation in delta. So with no control and that uncertainty, it's an 84% fidelity. Using the same number of parameters, 4 pulses, but 4 sets of parameters in the temporal case, I get a pretty good robust fidelity. But the magnitude is quite large compared to what you get when you do it spatially. Now this is dramatic, and in a lot of cases that I ran, it's not so dramatic, but the trend is always in the same direction. Uh-oh.
Yes.
You don't even have to touch this thing. It's okay. It's okay. All right, so the bottom line of this is that this kind of optimization can reveal designs that are not necessarily obvious. You have to look afterwards. In the cases we looked at, there was a range that looked pretty good for all the gates. It handles the controls and the uncertainty sets pretty much exactly as you describe them. And trying to figure out why it does this is interesting, but I have to be careful how I go around this. All right, so let me talk about fidelity estimation quickly. Fidelity is one number, and if you put the system in the right basis, in the process matrix, it's one element. So you'd think it would be easy. There's been work trying to do this exactly, but I'm going to show you a method that does it non-exactly and has the right relationship to the actual fidelity. And that's going to have to be really fast. This is a general setup for collecting data. And I'm assuming the observables are non-degenerate. Here's the main point of this slide. I can define the process matrix as the sum of the outer product of the vector of every OSR element. I think of that as the natural basis. The probability outcomes from all possible outcomes and observable pairs J is linear in the process matrix. The Z's just correspond to my input-output sets. Similarly, in that basis, the fidelity is also a linear combination of elements of the process matrix, but this time filtered through the desired unitary. So one way to do this is to do a least squares quantum process tomography, collect the data, get an empirical estimate of probability outcomes, and solve this convex optimization problem, which is very intensive, scales horribly. The other way is go to a basis which is appropriate to the desired unitary. Hopefully your system is near that in some sense, and it doesn't have to be that near, and then solve the problem via compressed sensing. And this is what we did in... I'll lend you my hand later if you want this. Here the scaling is interesting, and some we didn't work any further on this, but this is really kind of exciting in a way. The scaling is now, it's not n to the fourth when n is 2 to the q. It's not exponential necessarily. It scales as the sparsity of the process matrix in that basis and the number of qubits. And it may even be better than that. But, just very quickly. In my opinion, everybody here should learn how to use MATLAB with one of the convex solvers. This is the whole program for doing compressed quantum process tomography. So you really, it's a great tool, and you know, there it is. That's promotion. So we did experiment with this with Andrew White's group. This is with 30 configuration, 32. We match the data very well. I'm going to go past this because I'm going to run out of time. There's some interesting things, and I want to get to this. Okay, so back to the direct fidelity estimation. I'm going to rearrange all the kets that are available. So let's assume we have observables x, y, z. I'm going to take all the eigenvectors out of that and say have those available either as inputs or outputs, and just collect them in a configuration set. So then I'm going to ask a question. Can I take a linear combination of all these outcomes and make that close to the fidelity? Because they're both linear in the process matrix. And can I do it when I have a known set of process matrices, not every process matrix, a set that I get from the model, which is parameterized? And so that says if I can make this small, this is the error between the linear combination of probability outcomes and the actual fidelity, can I make this small over the whole set and use the fewest number? Well, that's another compressed sensing type problem. So I minimize the one norm of the coefficients that collect all the probability outcomes, and I make sure this is smaller than epsilon. But this is an infinite dimensional problem. If I sample, then I get a finite dimensional problem. And this is starting now to look in the more standard forms. P, the matrix P here is just the matrix of all the probability outcomes from all the unit vectors that I have available. And let me add that, of course, you don't get infinite data. You get finite data. So I'm going to use the Kramer-Rao bound on the probability outcomes to incorporate that into the it's a magic thingamajig. And now we have, this is the full L1 norm regularization problem with measurement error. And there's a competition now between what you pick to do sparsity versus what the noise picks to spread the business out. Okay. Remember, there's still something I'm going to reveal, so hang on. Okay, so there's 6 eigenvectors associated with the Pauli matrices, which means there's, in this setup, there's 36 configurations, 36 coefficients I want to pick. And I sampled from the omega z, omega z, x set 11 each, so I got 121 by 36 probability outcomes. Now we're going to solve this problem. I'm going to go around from that thing. And here's what, again, it's really interesting to me. So the first one, let me tell you what you're looking at. So this is log of base 10, 1 minus the actual fidelity. This is the fidelity error between the estimate and the true. And this is the configuration that the optimization says you should use to get a good estimate of the fidelity. It's one configuration. You use one eigenvector in the x direction, and you look through x and count how many times you get that, and that supposedly tracks fidelity. You can see in the blue for the identity that it basically hits it exactly. As soon as you get noise, though, and here we get noise from the sampling process, we only took 1,000 samples, you get this line. This line has the right slope because it says if I'm going to use this to learn something about the system, I want the errors to get smaller as the fidelity gets better. And that's what that's doing. I didn't ask to do that, but it did that. In the case of the Hadamard gate and the T gate, it's even more interesting. Again, it's one setup with a Z input and an X observable. And the T gate is a Z input and a Z observable. Don't look at the red, that's the noisy one. The blue is infinite data. And with infinite data, we're not getting 100% error, but we're getting the right slope. And again, I didn't know that that was possible with this. So it's a limited set in the laboratory, and this is what you get. I did a 2-qubit example just to see what that looked like. So here, again, it's assuming I have access to all 6 eigenvectors, so it's 6 to the 4th configurations, 1296. Again, 121 samples out of this system. This is a system with a kind of a bit flip followed into something that sort of looks like metrology, but it's made up just to have a problem. And again, you get the same kind of answers, a little more intricate. One setup, one experimental setup, and you get this fidelity estimation. And again, it has this tracking ability. This is a little bit steep, and in some cases, it hits it exactly with infinite data. So this was kind of interesting, amazing to me. So let me just recap this part. How much time do I have, Howard? Given all the... Oh, terrific. Okay, so this uses minimal resources via the L1 norm regularization. It's really ideal for following the gradient. I'm not demanding an unbiased estimate, as a lot of demands are made in some of the randomized benchmarking cases. The identity gate's a little bit of an exception. Because you can sort of figure out what's going on. And completely figure out, I don't know yet. Or not clear to me. Let me say something quickly about adaptive online tuning. So we want to use, let's say you wanted to use the fidelity estimate to adjust the control online from actual data. So you'd have a setup kind of like this. You'd prepare some state inputs. You'd do measurement. You'd do your fidelity estimation, do a robust control design, or keep iterating through that whole business. So here I incorporated something that we use all the time in process control, which is called run-to-run control. It's basically integral control. So you make the new value of the control variables equal to the previous one, plus some gain times the error. In this case, the error is 1, because that's the best you can do with fidelity, minus the estimate. And ideally, if you had the model, you should be able to pick a perfect gain to get rid of the error right away. With this particular method, this variance, you're going to double the variance of the error at best. But I just picked a gain of scalar gain. And on the left is the fidelity versus the number of iterations. So this, the upper one is, the gain is 1. There's 100 experiments per iteration and 50 iterations, and it climbs all the way up to fidelity 1 and produces, I guess, the red control. And then it moves this point, which was the original point, which I didn't know, down 2 or 3 orders of magnitude. Could do it with a higher gain, more experiments per configuration, and you get to the same place. Okay. I got to go back again, I'm afraid, to get near this thing. Let me pass that. To summarize here, this is not the end summary. We're getting near the end now. Okay, so numerical optimization can reveal, which is good. It can give you the performance and cost trade-offs that you want. My interpretation of a specific implementation and reducing the havoc is to get all this together and have a tool or an analytic understanding, which we don't have exactly, but the tool can guide you through this. And if you have to tune it, this begins to look like you can. So, okay, so I was in the shower a couple of weeks ago, and this came to me. What's been bothering me for more than a decade is that, it may not allow me to tell you this, is that How can we get four nines with what we call open loop control? That makes no sense. If you say that to any engineer, they'll laugh their heads off. But we keep seeing this in simulations. Okay, so something's hidden. Now, in the control world, what the community likes to lament about is that, well, control is ubiquitous, but it's hidden. Nobody knows how good we are. Yeah. So you have all these things that are there, that use the technology. And of course, you know, the famous fly ball governor, which is here, is hidden if you didn't know that that's what it was. And that's what, you know, I'm happy the symbol for the conference is the fly ball governor. And, you know, we've been searching for something like that for a long time. Okay. But there's a lot of, you know, feedback is hidden all over the place. It's hidden in evolution, at least according to Darwin and Wallace. If you like, it's hidden in the world of physics, at least according to Wheeler, with this eyeball looking back on itself to bring the universe into existence. It's hidden maybe in everything, according to various mystical and religious teachers of the 20th century. Okay, so let's come back down to Earth. And this is a typical schematic of an amplifier. And it hides the feedback. Feedback is that there's a high gain across the gate to source voltage that allows you to have this nice ratio of output to input voltage. This is a feedback loop. It wouldn't work without that. Okay. What about our favorite thing? Ready? Leaving this blank down. Where's the feedback hidden? We're designing this control, right? And we call it open loop control. But if I do this, it's not open loop control. It's not open loop control at all. What did I do, Howard Watson? I moved it out from under the parentheses. This is state feedback. Come on. Okay, you want to see it a different way. There's the loop. This is why this works. It's not open loop control. I know we say it's open loop control, but it's not. We need another term. Lorenzo used the term, I think, Hamiltonian engineering. That's a better term. It's on the way. So as a challenge, come up with a term. Of course, I showed this to Hirsch, and he said, "What? So what?" Well, it explains to me, and I think it ought to explain to anybody thinking about this, that's why we're getting this kind of incredible robustness from what we see as open loop control. It's not. Okay, something to think about. It's difficult. Even in this form, this has been a long-standing problem to design a control, a feedback control block that has specified structure. It goes under different names, direct output feedback, blah, blah, blah. Some people, I don't know if they've proven it to be NP-hard and so on, all kinds of things about it in the older control literature. So it's a difficult problem, but it may be difficult, but it's too difficult to let go. You have to have seen them. And this is the land of Tolkien, right? So, okay, that's it.
Time for questions?
We do.
Robert, I loved the last part. This is I really resonate with the last problem you have brought up. Like, I've been asking myself for a long time whether there is a commonality between what we call, what I also call, open loop Hamiltonian engineering. So it's not that I am immune to that. And the feedback. And what you're saying is that there is hidden feedback in the representation. What is a pure open loop control in anything that we have done then?
None.
Is that your answer?
Yeah, that's my answer.
Classically, there could be.
Right.
Classically, there could be. If you have a system and the output is linear in the input, then you could have an open loop control.
It's the very bilinear nature of
it. It's the bilinear nature, I think that's making this thing work in a general way,
really? But
without being specific. Otherwise it makes no sense.
That may be one way to maybe paraphrase what you're saying, I guess.
Or correct it, is what he means.
I think about CT as being like some top-level supervisor with pre-programmed open-loop instructions, right?
Yeah.
And then at the lower physical level, you're, you know, engaging and disengaging various physical instructions.
Right, right.
And it's at that lower level that the feedback that you're talking about is going.
Yeah, I mean, you could bring the
supervisory level,
right.
But there's no information going from side to C, right?
No.
But the feedback is happening at that lower level.
And yeah.
You're sort of turning that on and off as you adjust your seat.
Right, through the interaction of, all the couplings.
Physical interactions that are captured by
right.
the AC.
Right. But bringing C of T out and saying that's open loop controlling something else is not strictly, yeah, that's good what you said.
But I think that, I mean, of course you can do your cosmetic transformation and make it look like it's feedback, and I'm fine with it. But what the structure of that feedback loop does, essentially, is stabilize perfectly the norm of the vector. Okay, you're imposing a bilinear structure that keeps the norm constant. That's the basically what you need to do to have the evolution, a unitary evolution, right?
Maybe it's more than that.
No, no, that's inherent in it. That doesn't go away.
If you didn't have that structure, your state vector could change.
No, you could still have a state space system where you're hitting variables inside the equivalent Hamiltonian. Actually, you do that in satellite control. The system looks like that. And those states, of course, could fly out of whack. So I don't think that's it. I don't think it's cosmetic. Not an Estee Lauder.
Consider that any classical bilinear system would be a feedback system then as well.
Yeah.
That's what I was trying to ask.
Well, yeah. Be careful about this. The control has to, the C of T has to be good, not anything. But the reason it has robustness, when you analyze it, even the ones that give you 10 to the minus 16th at a particular point, and they rise up like this, up here, it's still robust. And it's still pretty good.
Isn't it just because we know the parameters of our system very well?
No. No, in fact, I showed you...
What you were saying,
yeah.
It works over a range.
Yeah, I showed you changes in control where the range was huge.
There is no physical situation that would justify error at the output channel.
Yeah.
The state channel.
Right.
So there is a little bit of a difference from looking at the other feedback.
No.
Okay, final question.
Okay, no, it's just really a comment that in the SLH block structure we have the inputs are all fields. We're working in the Heisenberg picture. With your block, they're states. So in a sense, it's working in the Schrodinger picture. The objects you're feeding in and feeding back.
Yeah, but you're still, I think you're still inside the Hamiltonian structure, although changed. They still have that bilinear part. Okay. Oh.
Well, I guess we're still. But it says another question while we try to get the next talk.
Oh, okay.
Set up. No, if not,
I guess in terms of this feedback structure, it's as you said, more like an output feedback, an output feedback rather than state feedback, because you've got a very specific structure, and that we know makes the problem hard
exactly.
And I guess the other point is that you're using a time varying feedback as well as say normal state feedback.
Well,
feedback. So in fact, using a time-varying feedback is one way you could
if you solve the time-varying LQG problem, you're going to get a time-varying state feedback through the Kalman filter, through the Riccati equation.
Right.
But in particular, if you're solving an output feedback problem and you just restrict attention to static controllers, you're very limited on what you can do.
Yeah.
But if you allow for some periodic or
time-varying
output feedback, you can do much more.
Right.
And that's kind of a way.
That's kind of what's happening, but you're also restricted because it's now a Hermitian structure.
Yeah, that's right. And there's those, all that unitary stuff is happening here as well.
Okay, let's thank Robert again.